You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702. Masterclass.
So 2 weeks ago, we got an email from Salamina, and she wrote in her email, Zimbabwe was back in the news recently, and I've been meaning to ask this question that comes up regularly in relation to Zimbabwe. Last year, SADC said it would organize activities to show solidarity with Zimbabwe and demonstrate their disapproval of sanctions imposed on the country by the European Union and the United Nations. I looked into this. Zimbabwe is still subject to sanctions that date back to the reign of former President Robert Mugabe, who was ousted in late 2017 and after 38 years in power. And from my understanding, the EU sanctions consist of an arms embargo and targeted asset freezes and travel bans, while the US has imposed financial restrictions and travel sanctions against selected individuals and entities. So, Azania, can you please do a masterclass on sanctions? And it goes on to say that this comes from Salamina. Yes, so Salamina, the day is here. We're bringing you that masterclass on sanctions. She concludes by saying, what is the history of sanctions? Who implements them? Why are sanctions implemented? And what are the different types? And does it actually work? So Salamina, we've decided to heed your request, as we always invite your ideas and your suggestions, not just for the masterclass, but for the show in general, by emailing Azania at 702.co.za. And this afternoon, we've invited Professor Adrian Saville to give us this outline, because there is an appeal in imposing economic sanctions. I think it's obvious enough, because it allows for there to be an achievement of diplomatic and foreign policy objectives without the use of military force. There's the appeal, and say a peaceful alternative to bloodshed, destruction and war. And so let's answer those questions with Professor Adrian Saville. We'll take your questions as well and your comments, 011-883-0702. I mean, this democracy, in fact, is said to have been birthed due to pressure from multiple quarters through different organizations, and that's what also bore enough pressure for the apartheid government to enter negotiations, amongst other reasons, of course. And so with that, let's kick things off. Good afternoon, Professor Adrian Saville. How are you?
Good to be with you, Zania. I'm very good, thanks.
Yes. So one of our listeners is curious, and I'm hoping that you can give everybody a map of this as a tool that countries lean on, and it's been ongoing. Even the times that we find ourselves in geopolitics, especially if you look at the U.S. foreign policy at the moment, they lean quite heavily on the use of sanctions. So let's maybe go back and try and understand how the idea and practice of sanctions developed over the past century or so.
Sanctions is a widely used tool, and stretch back not just over the past century, over, I guess, the course of human history, where, you know, sanctions in a political form, strategic political form, it takes the shape of an explicit and a declared action, in which there are generally, typically, multiple parties who are acting in concert with one another to achieve an outcome against another party, a third party, where there is concerted or agreed action and agreed outcomes as a result of that sanction. But, you know, sanctions are very much a human behavior or habit. Mm-hmm. And sanctions, you know, take many, many shapes, and they could go from, you know, just very, very modest sanctions. Well, you know, unless you do this, I'm not going to do that, in sort of a tit for tat type arrangement. But the intention behind a politically motivated sanction with a collective strategy is that there is an agreement that the party that you're trying to shift or move is doing something that is at odds with accepted norms, behaviors, and morality.
So it is about that. It's about asserting your dominance in order to bring about a change in behavior, a change in policy, a change in posture.
Exactly.
So it's premised on domination, that it's a tool that the powerful use to get the kind of results they want.
Yeah, I mean, we're quickly into the field of description, and perhaps we need to be just mindful that there are always two sides on each side of a sanction. That there is there are the people imposing the sanction, or the parties imposing the sanction, and there are the people on the receiving end. Now, this is a variant on war. And when we talk about war being an act of war being committed by one party on another, there's always two people at war, and very seldom do people go to war thinking I'm wrong, but to hell with it, I'll go to war anyway. We just need to be mindful, I suppose, that that on each side of the sanction, the people that who are the subject of the sanction may well believe that what they are doing is right, justifiable, defensible, but that for some reason, other parties, maybe even the world at large, has decided that what they are doing is wrong. And one of the best examples we have of this in a South African context is the sanctions that were imposed on South Africa under the apartheid regime to dismantle apartheid. And as you pointed out in the intro, those ultimately were successful in dismantling that regime.
Yes. No, I guess you are right that there are those examples. I guess I was thinking from the perspective of the more prevalent examples that we keep hear about, the more more pronounced examples that we keep hearing out about that pertain to, say, the EU, which is quite a dominant economy, the US as well, which is also a dominant player in the world. And they've often also imposed sanctions on smaller countries with less developed economies. But as you say, it's a variant on war.
Can I just stay with that point for a moment? Because I think you land at a really powerful example, is that what we've got going on right now in the world trade arena is a variant of sanctions. So in your introduction, you also said sanctions take a range of forms.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a variant of sanctions happening amongst two giants right now, and that's the United States and China, where they are each posturing and positioning themselves that, well, if you do that, we'll do this. And it's this tit-for-tat trade war. And you could call it a trade war, but this really is a form of sanctioning that, because you are doing that, I'm going to do this. And the intention is to inflict damage on the other party through this type of behavior. So it can be two giants stomping around in the trade arena, or it can be the entire world working in concert to lock South Africa out of international commerce and trade under apartheid. So it's a very, very wide spectrum when we use this term sanctions.
Yes, we had that transnational movement. So it can't. And then what about the form where it is unilateral, where it's a country acting like the US, for instance, they have acted based on going at it alone?
The closer you go to unilateral, I think the harder it is to make a case that you've got then the party imposing the sanctions acting in a collective interest. The more you go to unilateral sanctions, the more you're going to the interests of a single party. And you're making reference to the United States. There are many examples that we can find from the global arena.
Mm-hmm.
And what we also need to, well, so there are many examples, but you're absolutely right in pointing out what we can infer from unilateral sanctions. Mm. So that helps us read into the agenda and the intentions. And from there, you know, we can turn our attention to some of the impacts and implications.
Yes, yes. And that's part of the conversation that we're hoping to have this afternoon as well. As Salamina was asking, how does it work? And also, is it in essence effective? And I think we've got a mix of examples over the years. Would you agree about the effectiveness of sanctions, whether it's a tool that is effective ultimately as far as the goal is concerned, or whether it does more harm?
That's a very big point and an important part of this conversation, because very often when sanctions are imposed, it is the most vulnerable and fragile parts of society that carry the cost of that sanction, that carry the brunt or the burden of that sanction, and that the parts of society that have higher incomes, stronger balance sheet, greater international mobility are able to circumvent the sanctions. And indeed, entire industries have been built out of this what you call sanctions busting. And if we go back to the example of South Africa, what you found in the case of South Africa through the 1980s was tax havens were suddenly massive importers and exporters of components and equipment and commodities, where these tax havens, you know, what I will call sweepingly island economies, were being used to sanctions bust. And so it then, you know, makes a little bit of a nonsense out of the sanctions, because there is a pretense, a positioning globally that we're going to impose sanctions on you. You know, watch out. And then you build an entire rent-seeking industry of sanctions busting, and you get profiteering out of this. So, sanctions can in places be quite easily avoided or averted.
Yeah.
You find this in the case of China, United States, where a whole lot of products are now getting different stamps on them to show different source of origin. It has an inadvertent effect of giving birth to rent-seeking industries. Mm. And it can also very often, almost inevitably, have unintended, perverse and even tragic consequences. So a more recent case in point is Venezuela, where Venezuela has been has had sanctions imposed to try and dismantle that political arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, Venezuela loses access to its principal export market, which is the export of oil. It cripples the fiscus. They run out of dollars. You can't import, you can't get dollars to import antibiotics. Venezuela quickly becomes one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. And you also have the average adult losing almost 10 kilograms in body mass as a result of hunger. And inflation goes to 1,000,000% per annum. Now, you know, it doesn't. Well, the point that I want to make here is not one of morality. It's one of impact. And this is not about whether you think the Venezuelan government is right or wrong. It's about recognizing that children are dying as a result of sanctions.
Yes. And I think also the Iraq example proved to be also quite controversial because there was the Gulf War. It drove Iraqi forces from Kuwait. It left Saddam Hussein in power. And there were all those sanctions, lots of limitations on Iraq's ability to sell their oil and imports. And in the end, critics blamed the sanctions on the deaths of 500,000 children. That was the estimate given at the time. So those are some of the consequences, as you've made with the Venezuelan
and the figure for Venezuela is the figure for Venezuela is 200,000. So, you know, and you can think about the macroeconomic impact. I mean, 200,000 children dying is just, it's an almost incomprehensible number. You know, yes, it is on the way to achieve a political outcome, but you know, my point is about the social impact. Let's leave aside the politics for, you know, in acknowledging the social impact.
Mm-hmm. Let's take this call from Hassan, who's calling us from Lanesia. Hello, Hassan.
Hi. I'm interested in how popular power from below influences actions, either on states or governments or even leadership to take action. For example, now, global workers are on strike and they're calling on us not to buy certain products to put pressure on the company to meet their needs. Mm-hmm. The boycott, disinvestment and sanctions campaign, which started in amongst Palestinian civil society, they have been putting pressure for democratic rights and stuff like that in Palestine and Israel. Mm-hmm. But what you're finding that European governments have been trying to ban this form of legitimate non-violent protest, and even the European Court for Human Rights very recently came out to say that is an attack on civil liberty. So clearly, I think that we mustn't lose sight of the morality of that, which goes into Gandhi's passive resistance, satyagraha, and such like, Martin Luther King's strategies, you know, the day militant non-violence. I really think that is the key so that conscience can begin to take over. So I agree with the prof that it's not about morality, but I think you cannot leave the justness of a cause. Even in our case, Bishop Tutu and others were championing the call to say, well, we are prepared to take the suffering, but for the greater good.
Right. Hassan, thank you for your call. Your reflections on Hassan's call, Adrian?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not in any way suggesting that we can sweep aside or ignore the intention of those sanctions, whether it's, you know, a soft sanction like an embargo or a very hard sanction where in its hardest form, sanction takes the shape of war. And you know, I'm not for one moment suggesting that we can ignore the intention or the intended outcome, but we have to acknowledge that, you know, on the way to achieving that outcome, there can be devastating social and economic consequences, and you know, these stretch across borders and across time, whether we use the example from the 1990s of Kuwait, or the more recent instance of the Iranian nuclear proliferation debate, or even sanctions that look backwards in time, such as the United Nations Declaration on Rhodesia, and
yes,
where so sanctions are imposed to try and dismantle something, and that what they are trying to dismantle are things that are intended to bring about cooperation or collaboration with, we can, you know, call it international laws or international norms and international morality. The second type of sanction is one that is intended to prevent something. So in the first instance, that, you know, that bad thing is already happening and you're trying to bring your country in line with international laws and orders. The second is you're trying to prevent something from happening. Nuclear war is a case. And the third might be backward looking, mm-hmm. where it's going to deem something to have been or condemn something. And Rhodesia is a sad recent case in point.
Yes, yes.
And just to stay with that previous point, mm-hmm. also to acknowledge that, you know, whilst I'm defaulting to talking about sanctions as if they are always imposed from the top, sanctions can be imposed from beneath also. And what I mean by that is sanctions can be soft and social, and soft power can be exceptionally strong. And I would venture that some of the greatest actions that dismantled mm-hmm. apartheid were actually the sanctions, the social sanctions brought about by trade unions, church groups, women's movement, youth movement. You know, those are soft social sanctions brought about from beneath, you know, not imposed by the United States or Europe.
Yes, as Hassan was alluding to, the boycotts that start from below, the movements that start and then filter upwards. So let's bring you the latest in. We'll be taking headlines in a moment. I can't see the clock quite clearly. Sorry about that, Adrian. What do you think of smart sanctions? Because part of Salamina's email suggests that, you know, the strategies that the EU took against Robert Mugabe's regime, government, and the strategies that the US took, you know, she outlined some of those, you know, there's a freezing of bank accounts and so on. So what do you think of smart sanctions, the targeting of bank accounts and travel privileges of the elite? Because that's what is often said about Zimbabwe under Robert Mugabe and now with Mnangagwa, is that this doesn't target ordinary people. And yet ordinary people are the ones that are suffering the most.
You know, that's ideal. I often get in trouble with my wife for using family examples or marriage examples, and I don't want this in any way to reflect on my marriage. I'm very happily married, just for so that that disclaimer is given ahead of my mm-hmm. bad example. Mm-hmm. But you know, where you know, imagine that you have a couple, a husband and wife couple, where they impose sanctions on each other to achieve certain outcomes. You know, they can imagine that the sanctions that they're imposing on each other are very, very smart. But there are things that you know, that we would call collateral damage. And almost invariably, the collateral damage is displayed, you know, at the level of the couple, but it is carried at the level of the children. And, you know, that's the point that I'm trying to really emphasize in thinking about sanctions, is we need to be wide ranging in measuring our impacts, and we need to be very mindful that there are second and third order effects that very often are unintended, and they can be deep and long lasting in negative impact. So, you know, if smart sanctions can be targeted, they can achieve with minimum collateral damage exactly what you want to achieve, then what a fantastic way to do this. And if you can use soft power before you use hard power, you can think of music and sports sanctions that were imposed on South Africa. You know, if soft power can be used before hard power, then these are good ways, you know, that might bring about best possible outcomes with minimum possible damage.
Well, let's take a break and we'll come back to this discussion.
702
Masterclass. It's 21 minutes to 3 o'clock. We're talking about sanctions, as been requested by Salamina, who was talking about Zimbabwe. And this afternoon, we're hanging out with Professor Adrian Saville. And Adrian, it looks like some of our listeners have taken umbrage with you referring to Zimbabwe as Rhodesia, and me allowing that, because I actually thought you were referring to those sanctions when it was Rhodesia all those years ago. And of course, we know it's Zimbabwe right now.
Now, I want to be absolutely clear. The United Nations spoke about what was done in Rhodesia. So I'm not I'm in no way referring to the country now.
Mm.
I'm referring to the country under the Smith administration, as it was called then, Rhodesia.
Yes.
And the United Nations imposed sanctions on the country then.
Which were also deemed to be a failure because it damaged the economy. The government was, yes, isolated, which was the desired effect. But they had South Africa, which was undercutting the sanctions.
Yeah, you know, so, well, I hope that that clears up any confusion, that I'm certainly not referring to the country today as that. You know, you're absolutely right. We've made, you know, we made the point earlier that if there are ways of sanctions busting, of getting around, what you want to make sure is that you've got as many people on your side as possible in imposing sanctions. Otherwise, it's quite easy to circumvent and sanctions bust, as was done in the 1980s. More recent examples would include Iran, I think, is a good case in point, mm-hmm. where the United States imposed sanctions on Iran, but you know, very quickly you can pivot. There's the word of 2020 to other parts of the economic and financial arrangement, and you can find people who will replace the United States in your international relations. So you want to make sure that if you are imposing sanctions, that those sanctions can be endorsed multi-party. And that they are imposable. You also want to make sure that the sanctions are very specific and clear. That it's not just a case of, well, we're imposing sanctions for some fairly obscure reason that you might get some change in behavior, but it's never quite clear what you are trying to achieve or when the success condition or the victory condition of the sanctions has been met. And possibly Cuba and North Korea are examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So be quite specific. So coming out of that, I'm also curious about the style of taking the unilateral route. As you said, that what can make it quite successful is when it is entered into with other role players and not going at it alone, because then it's possible to circumvent or to undercut the sanctions. And so the US's unilateral sanctions, is that an approach that is sound when you look at how often Donald Trump more recently has been using it as a tool to get the sort of outcome that he wants from other nations? And does it not render it vulnerable? And also, does it not make this tool of sanctions, does it not weaken it if it is something that's pulled up ever so often all the time and also going at it alone? Does it not weaken it?
You know, maybe to take a step backwards, and we keep landing on this U.S. Because the U.S. has been fairly prolific in imposing sanctions. And the U.S. has sanctions against more than two dozen countries. And more than you can also sanction companies and individuals. You don't have to only, you know, that's the smart or the targeted sanctions. So the U.S. has sanctions against two dozen countries. The U.S. has sanctions against 7,000 companies and individuals. And this is more economic sanctions than any other time in history. So there's a huge amount of positioning going on in terms of their aims and objectives. And I don't, you know, mean to suggest sort of any veiled or underhanded reference there. The U.S. is the world's largest economy. It is the world's economic power. Mm. And for a long time has been appointed as a custodian. Now, just keep aside, you know, all of the judgments and the moralities for a moment. I'm trying to make, you know, comments of fact rather than opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at the success, I'll put that also in inverted commas, because it depends on which side you are on. But when we look at the success of sanctions, the intended outcomes, your likelihood of getting a result is about a 50-50 chance. Wow. So sanctions have not showered themselves in glory as a tool of achieving intended outcomes. And there's a range of reasons for that. You underestimate the power of the or the strength of the person you're imposing the sanctions on. You underestimate the ability of the person you're imposing sanctions on to find new friends. You overestimate the strength of your relationship with the person that you're imposing sanctions on. And you may also underestimate second order effects. So a large country imposes sanctions on a small country. And instead of pushing that small country into isolation, it galvanizes the population of that small country into fierce opposition, and you form a resistance movement in that country that you've imposed sanctions on, which was never your intention. Mm. So this is, I mean, it really is a minefield when trying to think about A, what the intentions are, the morality, the ethic, the intended outcomes, and if they are effective in any shape or form, the odds really look like 50-50 stuff.
I think it was a scholar who said that, if I remember this correctly, that sanctions are like a tiger without teeth, or was it without claws, but able to growl. So I think it speaks to what you're saying there, that it's, you know, it doesn't have any teeth, but it certainly growls, and that's the extent of it. What about,
there are ways that you can give sanctions teeth, you know, and maybe these are easier points to make, because when we look at the success of sanctions, these are the things that tend to correspond with greater success. The first is that you have a very specific and clear directive or objection that you make to the party that you're imposing sanctions on. You know, and that is, you are doing X, you need to stop doing X because of Y, and we need to have evidence that you have stopped doing that and redressed all of those wrongdoings by date Z. You know, those are very clear, very specific, and you know what the counterparty's required response is. So I think that that's one way in which you can make sanctions, or give them some teeth, give our tiger teeth. Now let's give the tiger claws. And the way that you add claws is, the evidence also suggests that if you go after wide-ranging rather than specific, and the wide-ranging would be something like the financial system. So if you sanction the financial system or access to a financial system, so for instance, if you sanction access to the U.S. banking system or the international monetary system, as opposed to imposing a sanction on goods, services, or a range of products. And generally, the way sanctions are carried out is the sanctions are imposed on a specific product like oil or arms. But the evidence is that the sanctions tend to have far greater effect when they bar access to powerful systems rather than a country's particular products.
Right.
And that would give your tiger claws with teeth.
Yes. And doesn't that also depend on... And this maybe takes us into the next arena, when you look at the institutions that are able to bring the countries together for them to be able to come together and agree on sanctions against a particular government or regime. The example that you pose now about targeting, say, oil, thinking about the United Nations and the General Assembly and the disagreements or the sway and influence of the US and the UK. I'm trying to remember the particular country that was affected, but when this could not go to it was in the General Assembly in the UN, and it meant that it was voluntary. So in the General Assembly, their call for sanctions would remain voluntary. So if it doesn't go to the Security Council, which involves the veto of these powerful countries, then it can still be left to be without the claws, without the teeth. So what of then the bodies, the United Nations in this particular case? You mentioned earlier the League of Nations, for instance, that now it's the UN, of course. So what of their credibility and the voices and the platform that they provide for sanctions to be effectively instituted?
Well, you know, I think that we've got a range of examples from history, and you know, those sanctions included, or those declarations by the United Nations included actions on what was Southwest Africa. I need to be very clear now so that I'm not misunderstood. But what was Southwest Africa and then under independence became Namibia. We can go back to the point that I was making about, you know, what was Rhodesia, where the General Assembly and the United Nations voted 107-2 after independence was declared in 1965, Rhodesian independence in 1965, the UN voted 107-2 and they condemned what was then Rhodesia on all military, economic, as well as oil and petroleum products. So, you know, if you think of where Southwest Africa lands up as a democratic and independent Namibia, Rhodesia becomes Zimbabwe, and indeed the same for South Africa. Sanctions in all three instances, one could venture, have been effective in dismantling illegitimate political regimes.
So you think that these bodies, the body succeeded, of course, because history tells us so?
Well, yeah. You know, yes, if the intention was to dismantle an illegitimate political regime, then those United Nations Security Council resolutions and declarations have been effective because the minority government in Rhodesia is gone. The apartheid government in South Africa is gone, and Southwest Africa is an independent country with a democratically elected sovereign status. So yes, by those measures, those have been effective. Now, you know, if you want to add into that, well, what do we think has happened to, you know, the economic performance, and are people better off, and so on? You know, that's another facet of this, or could this have been achieved in a different way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're into the debate of was this the best way and the quickest way and the fairest way? Because North Korea has been under sanctions for decades, but the elite in North Korea are living large. They're fine and well.
Let's conclude our session, Adrian, by looking at the future of sanctions. The currency, the dominance of the dollar, for instance, and the way in which you mentioned China and the US, the fight that they're current, the trade war that they're currently embroiled in. Russia wants to also assert itself as a global power. So to what extent does that affect the future of something like sanctions? If we are to look at the dominant currency, the global currency, which is the dollar, and of course, this fight that is happening to unseat the US.
So, you know, on that score, I made the point at the in my opening comments that there is nothing new about sanctions. And we can go back 200 years and we find Napoleon opposing British trade. You know, so that's the French and the British against each other in trade wars. More recently, we've got, you know, that iterates to become the United States with their sanctions against 24 countries. So I make this point because if we go back 200 years, it's the European countries that dominate global politics, global military, global economics. If we fast forward to now, it is the United States that stands dominant. So if we want to think about the future of sanctions, I think it would equip us to think about, you know, who has the power bases. And you've arguably already mentioned them, you know, that the power bases of the next generation are likely to sit squarely with the United States and China. And so if you want to try and make sense of what's likely to be coming down the line at us in terms of sanctions, I think it equips us to think about what their philosophies, policies, and ambitions are in the global setting.
Right. It's absolutely fascinating. So do you, the future, it still has a place in how we resolve challenges, how we resolve conflict in the world. Yeah. Or do you see it changing? And I like what Haseen had called about talking up, and you referenced it as well, the soft power, boycotts coming from the populace and some of this change coming from below versus at a state level.
Yeah. Look, as long as we've got people, we will have disagreement. Mm. We will have differences. We will have different moral, ethical, political bearings and compasses. And that gives you a seedbed for opposing views and disagreement, which in their most destructive form take the shape of warfare and social oppression. And we've got the history of the world is riddled with examples of societies that have been oppressed and subject to misrule and oppression. And, you know, that leads me to strongly suspect that there's no reason to believe that this type of behavior is going to go away anytime soon. Hmm. So very sadly, the reason for sanctions is going to stay in place. And whether those sanctions are very soft or very hard, you know, history will show us the course that we have chosen. Hmm. In a perfect world, we can resolve our disagreements and we can bring about unjust and authoritarian regimes and oppressive regimes. We can bring them to order and we can remove oppression and injustices with soft power. But, you know, again, history is a guide and it doesn't feel great to finish a discussion like this with a glib comment. But I think we look to history to guide us on in the future.
Well, Professor Adrian Saville, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us on this discussion and honoring Salamina's request.
Thank you.
That was Professor Adrian Saville, Chief Executive at Canon Asset Managers and Professor in Economics, Finance and Strategy at Gibbs, guiding us on this conversation, this masterclass on sanctions.